wide, and it was this proximity that, at first sight, gave the impression that everything in this area was just an overgrown clump of trees. It was a very dark night. As I followed this first circular alleyway round to see if I could find an opening in the hedgerow, I passed below the supper room, and seeing that they had all left, my anxiety greatly increased. However, I continued searching, and in this way arrived level with the window of the great underground hall which was located underneath the room reserved for day-to-day orgies. I could see that this room was well lit, and I was bold enough to approach it, looking down into the room from where I was standing. My unfortunate companion was stretched out on a rack. She had little hair left, and was doubtless destined to undergo some dreadful torture which would finally set her free of all her woes. I trembled, but was soon amazed by what I saw then. Either Omphale did not know everything, or she had not told me all, for I saw four naked girls in this cellar who appeared very beautiful and extremely young to me, and who certainly did not belong to our group. So there were other victims of the lust of these monsters in this dreadful refuge, other unfortunate girls unknown to the rest of us. I hastened to flee, and continued to follow the path round until I was right on the other side opposite the cellar. Having failed so far to find an opening in the hedge, I resolved to make one. Without anyone noticing, I had equipped myself with a long knife. I set about working with it. Despite the gloves I was wearing, my hands were soon covered in cuts, but nothing stopped me. The hedge was more than 2 feet thick, but I managed to open it up sufficiently to reach the second enclosure. There, I was astonished to feel the earth to be soft, giving way beneath my feet, and I sank into it up to my ankles. The further I advanced through these dense copses, the darker they became. Curious to know the reason for this change in terrain, I felt with my hands. Oh, heaven! I was holding a skull! Dear God, I thought in horror, this is doubtless the cemetery where these torturers throw the bodies of their victims, just as I had been told. They scarcely take the trouble to cover them with earth. This skull was perhaps that of my dear Omphale, or of the unfortunate Octavie, so beautiful, so sweet, so good, and who appeared on earth like the rose of whose loveliness she was the very image. Alas, that would have been my fate too. Why not simply submit to it? What would I gain from leaving, only to find new setbacks? Have I not committed enough crimes here? Have I not here become the cause of enough crimes? Oh, let me fulfill my destiny. Oh, earth, open up and swallow me. When one is as forsaken, as poor, as abandoned as I, why should one make such efforts to lead such a pointless existence any longer in the company of such monsters? No. No, I must avenge virtue in chains. She expects me to have the courage to do so. I should not allow myself to be cowed. I must go forward. It is essential that the world be rid of villains as dangerous as these. Must I fear causing the loss of a handful of men's lives in order to save those of millions of individuals, sacrificed to their savagery or their philosophy? And so I cut through the hedge at the place where I was. This one was thicker than the other. The further forward I went, the harder it became. I do manage to make a hole, but the soil closes up on the other side. There is no longer any sign of those same horrors I had just encountered. In this way, I arrive at the edge of the ditch without finding the high wall that Omphale had told me about. It probably did not exist, it being likely that the monks only told us about it to scare us more. Less shut in on the other side of this sixfold enclosure, I was better able to make out the objects around me. The church and the main building that backed onto it were immediately visible to me. The ditch bordered both. I was careful not to attempt to cross it from here. I followed the edge round, and finding myself eventually opposite one of the forest paths, I resolved to cross it there and to set off along that road when I had climbed up the other side. This ditch was very deep, but, fortunately for me, it was dry. As it was brick-lined, there was no way of sliding down, and so I jumped. A little stunned by my fall, it took me a few moments to get back on my feet. I carried on, and reached the other side without encountering any obstacles. But how was I to climb up? Searching carefully for a suitable spot, I eventually found one where a few bricks had come loose, giving me the chance to use them as rungs and to stick my foot into the earth to support myself. I had soon almost reached the top, when everything gave way under my weight, and I fell back into the ditch beneath all the debris I had dislodged. I thought I was dead. This fall, which was an involuntary one, had been harder than the other. What's more, I was completely covered by all the material that had fallen on top of me. Some of this had struck me on the head, and my skull was cracked. "Oh, dear Lord," I said to myself in despair. "Let us not go any further. Let us stay here. This is a warning from heaven which does not want me to go on. My ideas are probably wrong. Perhaps evil is of some use on earth, and when the hand of God wills it so, perhaps it is wrong to oppose it." But quickly revolted by such an idea, which was the all too sorry fruit of the corruption that had surrounded me, I removed all the debris I was covered with, and finding it easier to climb up to the hole I had just made because of the fresh holes that had appeared, I tried again with renewed courage and got to the top in a flash. All of this had taken me further away from the path I had caught sight of before, but, having carefully sought it out, I managed to get onto it and began to flee with all speed. I found myself outside the forest before the end of the day, and was soon on the hillock from which, to my misfortune, I had spotted that dreadful monastery 6 months earlier. Perspiring heavily, I rested for a moment. My first thought was to fall to my knees and beg God's forgiveness once again for the sins I had been forced to commit in that odious receptacle of impurity and crime. Tears of regret soon flowed from my eyes. "Alas," I said to myself, "I was far less a criminal when I left that same path last year, prompted by a principle of devotion so fatally deceived. Oh, dear God, what a state I am now in!" These gloomy reflections were dispelled a little by the pleasure of finding myself free again, and I continued on my way to Dijon, imagining that only in that city would my grievances be legitimately received.
Here Madame de Lorsange wished to persuade Thérèse to draw breath, at least for a few moments. She certainly needed to do so. The passion she invested in her story, the wounds that these gloomy accounts reopened in her heart, all finally forced her to pause for a little while. Monsieur de Corvie had refreshments brought in, and, after a short rest, our heroine resumed the tale of her deplorable adventures, as follows.
On my second day, my initial fears about being pursued had completely vanished. It was extremely hot, and, taking my usual precautions, I had left the path to find some shelter where I might have a light meal that would fortify me before evening. A little copse in the wood to the right of the path, in the middle of which flowed a clear, bright stream, seemed to me the perfect spot to refresh myself. My thirst quenched by this pure fresh water, and nourished by a little bread, I rested with my back against a tree and allowed the pure, still air to circulate through my veins, restoring my strength and calming my senses. There, my thoughts turned to that destiny, one practically without example, which in spite of the thorns surrounding me on my journey of virtue, and whatever might happen to me, always brought me back to my religious faith, to acts of love and submission to the supreme being who inspires it, and of whom it is the very image. A sort of enthusiasm had just gripped me. Mercifully, I told myself, the good Lord that I adore has not abandoned me, since I have even now found the means to repair my strength. Is it not to him that I owe this good fortune? And are there not individuals on this earth to whom it is refused? So, I am not entirely wretched, since there are still those more to be pitied than I. Oh, am I not far less to be pitied than those unfortunates that I am leaving behind in that den of vice, from which God in his goodness has saved me by some sort of miracle? And full of gratitude, I had sunk to my knees, turning to the sun as the finest work of the Godhead, as that which is the greatest manifestation of his greatness, and finding in the sublime beauty of this star a fresh impulse to pray and offer thanks, when suddenly I felt myself to be seized by two men who, having covered my head to stop me seeing what was happening and crying out, bound me like a criminal and dragged me off without uttering a word. We had been walking like this for 2 hours without its being possible for me to see which road we were on when, hearing me breathing with difficulty, one of my guides suggested to his companion that they remove the veil covering my head. He agreed to this, and I could breathe. I also noticed that we were in the middle of a forest, on a road that was fairly wide, though little used. A myriad gloomy thoughts then entered my head, and I feared that I was being taken back to their odious monastery. "Oh, monsieur," I said to one of my abductors, "I beg you to tell me where you are taking me. May I not ask what you intend to do with me?"
"Calm yourself, my child," this man said to me. "The precautions we are obliged to take should not cause you any anxiety, because we are taking you to a very kind master. There are excellent reasons why he feels it necessary to employ such mysterious methods to select chambermaids for his wife, but you will be fine there."
"Alas, sirs," I replied, "if all you wish is to make me happy, there is no reason to restrain me. I am a poor orphan who is greatly to be pitied, I have no doubt. All I ask for is a position somewhere, and if this is what you are giving me, why would you be afraid that I might run away?"
"She's right," said one of the men. "Let's make her more comfortable and just keep her hands bound."
They did this, and we continued on our way. Seeing that I came quietly, they even answered my questions, and I eventually learnt from them that the master to whom they were taking me was called the Comte de Gernande, that he was born in Paris and possessed considerable wealth in that part of the country, amounting in all to more than 500,000 livres income, which, according to one of my guides, was his alone to enjoy. Alone?
"Yes, he is a solitary man, a philosopher. He never sees anyone. On the other hand, he is one of the greatest gluttons in Europe. There isn't a single man in all the world who is capable of eating as much as him. I needn't tell you any more. You'll see for yourself."
"But why these precautions, monsieur?"
"I'll explain. Our master has the misfortune of having a wife who has lost her mind. She must be kept under surveillance. She does not leave her room and no one wishes to serve her. There would have been no point proposing it to you because if you'd known about this, you would never have accepted. We are obliged to abduct girls by force to exercise this sad duty."
"What? Do you mean that I will be a prisoner serving this lady?"
"Actually, yes. That's why we are holding you like this. You'll be comfortable there. You need not worry. Perfectly comfortable. Apart from these constraints, you will want for nothing."
"Oh, dear heaven, what a situation."
"Come, come, my child, be brave. You'll be able to leave one day and your fortune will be made."
My guide had scarcely finished speaking when we caught sight of the castle. It was a superb and vast building isolated in the middle of the forest, but the number of people in this grand edifice was considerably smaller than it appeared capable of housing. The only parts of the castle where I saw some activity in comings and goings were the kitchens, which were situated in cellars beneath the centre of the main building. All the rest was as solitary as the location of the castle. No one took any notice of us when we entered. One of my guides went down to the kitchens while the other presented me to the Comte. He was at the end of a vast and superb apartment, wrapped in a dressing gown of Indian satin and lying on an ottoman with two young men next to him. They were so indecently, or rather so ridiculously attired and coiffured with such style and elegance, that I at first took them for girls. When I had examined them more closely, I eventually realized that they were both boys, one of whom was 15 years old or thereabout, the other 16. They appeared extremely good-looking, but were both in such a state of passivity and prostration that I first thought they were ill.
"Here's a girl, Monseigneur," said my guide. "She seemed to us to be just what you require. She is sweet-natured, honest, and all she asks for is a position in service. We hope that you will be pleased with her."
"Very good," said the Comte, barely glancing at me. "You will lock the doors before retiring, Saint-Louis, and you will allow no one to enter unless I ring for them."
Then the Comte got up and came over to examine me. While he is looking me up and down, I can describe him to you. The singularity of his portrait merits your attention for a moment. Monsieur de Gernande was at that time a man 50 years of age, nearly 6 foot tall, and monstrously fat. His countenance was more terrifying than anything I've seen. The length of his nose, his thick, dark eyebrows, his wicked black eyes, his wide mouth and bad teeth, his dark, bald forehead, the sound of his raucous and frightening voice, his enormous hands and arms, all contributed to make him a gigantic individual whose appearance inspired much less confidence than fear. We shall soon see whether the morality and actions of this centaur matched his terrifying appearance. Following the most cavalier and cursory of examinations, the Comte asked me how old I was.
23 years, monsieur, I replied.
He followed up this initial question with a few more about my history. I told him everything about myself, and did not even leave out the branding I had received from Rodin. When I had described my miserable condition to him, proving to him that misfortune had ever dogged my steps, the hateful man said to me harshly,
"So much the better. You'll fit in more easily here. It is but a very small misfortune that bad luck pursues that abject race of people that nature condemns to crawl alongside us on the same earth. They are more active and less insolent in consequence, and better fulfil their duties towards us."
"But, sir, I have told you of my origins, which are not lowly."
"Yes, yes, I know all that. People always pretend to be all sorts of things when they are nothing or in misery. The illusions of pride must necessarily offer consolation for the ills of fortune. It's then up to us to believe what we want to about these tales of the high-born brought low by the blows of fate. Anyway, I don't care about any of this. I find that you have the look and more or less the dress of a servant, and so I shall take you on as such if it pleases you. However,"
this hard man continued,
"whether or not you will find happiness is entirely in your hands. If you are patient and discreet, I shall send you away in a few years with sufficient means to live on without needing to find another situation in service."
Then he took hold of one arm and then the other, and folding my sleeves up to the elbow, carefully examined them, asking me how many times I had been bled.
"Twice, monsieur," I told him, rather surprised by this question, and I explained when and in what circumstances in my life this had taken place. He pressed his fingers on the veins to make them stand out in order to proceed with this operation, and when they had reached the desired point, he applied his mouth to them and sucked. From then on, I had no doubt that libertinism was part of this hateful man's way of life, and the torments of anxiety were again awakened in my heart.
"I have to know what you look like," continued the Comte, staring at me in a manner that made me tremble. "The duties you must perform require that you possess no physical disabilities, so let's see what you have."
I objected, but all the muscles of the Comte's terrifying physique seemed disposed to anger, and he sternly declared that he would not advise me to play the prude with him, since he had the means certain to make women see reason.
"What you have told me," he said to me, "does not suggest that you are especially virtuous, and so any resistance on your part would be as out of place as it would be ridiculous."
With these words, he gestured to his young boys, who immediately came up to me and set about undressing me. With individuals as weak and as enervated as those around me, it would most assuredly not have been difficult to defend myself. But what would have been the point? The anthropophagus, who set them onto me, could have pulverized me with a single blow of his fist, had he so wished, and so I realized that I was obliged to give in. I was undressed in a flash, and scarcely had this been done when I noticed that once again I was making these two Ganymedes laugh.
"My friend," the younger boy said to the other, "a girl is a lovely thing, but what a shame there's nothing down there."
"Oh," said the other boy, "there's nothing more vile than that hole. I wouldn't touch a woman even for a fortune."
And while my front passage was so sarcastically ridiculed by them, the Comte, intimate devotee of the behind, regrettably, alas, like all libertines, was examining mine with the greatest attention, handling it roughly,
kneading it forcefully and pinching my flesh between his fingers, he pummeled it until it was black and blue. He then made me walk a few steps forward and backwards towards him so that he would not lose sight of his chosen part. When I had got back to him, he made me bend over, stand upright, clench my buttocks, then spread them. He often knelt before this part of my body, which alone interested him. He directed kisses to several different spots, several even to the most secret of orifices, but all these kisses were the epitome of suction, not one of them that did not have this action as goal. He seemed to suckle each of the spots to which he applied his lips. It was during this examination that he asked me to recount every detail of what had been done to me at the monastery of Sainte-Marie-des-Bois, and not noticing that I was redoubling his lusts in telling these tales, I naively told him everything with complete candour. He called one of his young men over, and placing him next to me, undid the knot of a long piece of red ribbon that held up a pair of white gauze pants, revealing all those charms hidden by this garment. After a few gentle caresses directed to the same altar upon which the Comte had made his sacrifice with me, he completely changed the focus of his attention and began to suck the part of this child that characterized his sex. He continued touching me. Whether out of habit on the young man's part, or skill on the part of this satyr, within a very few minutes nature vanquished, filled the mouth of the latter with the liquid that spurted from the member of the former. This is how this libertine exhausted these unfortunate children that he kept in his house, and the number of whom we shall soon see. He weakened them in this manner, and this was the cause of the languid state in which I had found them. We shall now see how he managed to put the women into the same state, and the real reason why he kept his own wife in seclusion. The homage that the Comte had paid to me had lasted a long time, but without the slightest infidelity to the temple that he had chosen. Neither his hands, nor his looks, nor his desires had deviated from it for an instant. Having also sucked the other young man, and received and devoured his seed in the same way, "Come," he said to me, bidding me follow him into an adjoining closet without even letting me recover my clothes. "Come, I'm going to show you what is going on here." I could not conceal my dreadful anxiety, but there was no way of turning my fate around. I had to drain the chalice that was presented to me to the dregs. Two other young men of 16, just as handsome, just as weak as the first two that we have left in the drawing room, were working at a tapestry in this closet. They rose when we entered.
"Narcissus," said the Comte to one of them, "this is the Comtesse's new chambermaid, and I have to put her to the test. Give me my lancets."
Narcissus opened a cupboard and immediately took out everything needed for bloodletting. I will leave it to you to imagine what happened to me. My torturer saw my confusion, but just laughed.
"Get her ready, Zephyr," said Monsieur de Gernande to the other young man.
And approaching me, this child said to me with a smile, "Don't be afraid, mademoiselle. It can only do you the greatest good. Position yourself like this." I had to kneel on the edge of a stool, placed in the center of the chamber, with my arms held by two black ribbons attached to the ceiling. I had hardly adopted this posture when the Comte approached me, lancet in hand. He was scarcely breathing, his eyes sparkled, and he wore a frightening expression. He bound my arms, and in less than the blink of an eye, he had pierced both of them. He let out a cry, accompanied by a few blasphemies, as soon as he saw blood, and went to sit 6 feet away opposite me. The light garment that covered him was soon unwrapped, Zephyr kneeling between his legs to suck him, while Narcissus, both feet resting on his master's chair, offered him to suck the same object that Gernande himself had the other boy pump. Gernande grabbed hold of Zephyr's thighs, squeezing them and pressing himself against them, and yet stopped doing so to cast fiery looks at me. Meanwhile, my blood was gushing out of me, falling into two white basins placed under my arms. I soon felt myself weaken.
"Monsieur," I cried, "have pity on me. I am fainting."
And I tottered, though I could not fall since I was held up by the ribbons. However, with my arms waving around and my head wobbling on my shoulders, my face was drenched with blood. The Comte was drunk with lust, but I did not see the end of this procedure, fainting before it reached its climax. Perhaps he was not able to achieve this until he saw me in this condition. Perhaps his supreme ecstasy depended on this image of death. Whatever the truth of this, when I recovered my senses, I found myself in an excellent bed with two old women nearby. As soon as they saw that my eyes were open, they offered me broth, and every 3 hours, excellent soups for 48 hours. When this time was up, Monsieur de Gernande sent word for me to get up and come to speak to him in the same drawing room where he had received me when I arrived. I was taken there, still a little weak, and yet in quite good health. When I arrived, the Comte bade me sit and said to me,
"Thérèse, I shall not subject you to such trials very often. You are useful to me for other purposes. However, it is essential that I explain my tastes to you and the way in which you will come to an end in this house if you betray me, if you have the misfortune to allow yourself to be suborned by the woman with whom I am going to place you."
"This woman is my wife, Thérèse, a status that is doubtless the most deadly she could have, since it obliges her to lend herself to the strange passion of which you have just been victim. Do not imagine that I treat her in this way out of vengeance or contempt, or any feeling of hatred. It is simply a matter of passion. Nothing equals the pleasure I feel spilling blood. I am in ecstasy when it flows. I have never enjoyed this woman any other way. It's 3 years ago since I married her, and every 4 days precisely since then she undergoes the same treatment that you experienced. Her extreme youth. She is not yet 20 years old. The special care that we take of her, all this sustains her, and as we restore in her what we force her to lose, she has been in very good health since that time. Given such a condition, you will understand that I cannot allow her to go out or to be seen by anyone. I therefore give out that she is mad, and her mother, the only relative she has left, and who lives in her castle 6 leagues from here, is so convinced of this that she does not even dare come to see her. The Comtesse begs for mercy often enough, and there is nothing she will not do to move me. But she will never succeed. My lusts have dictated her sentence, which cannot be changed, and she will continue in this way for as long as she is able. She will want for nothing during her life, and as I enjoy exhausting her, I shall keep her going for as long as possible. And when she is no longer able to stand it, all well and good. She is my fourth, and I shall soon have a fifth. Nothing concerns me less than the fate of a woman. There are so many in the world, and it is good to make changes. Be that as it may, Thérèse, your job is to take care of her. She regularly loses 2 bowls of blood every 4 days, but does not faint any more. She has gained strength from the habit. Her exhaustion lasts for 24 hours, and she is well for the remaining 3 days. However, as you will readily understand, this life displeases her, and there is nothing she would not do to escape it, nothing she would not undertake to communicate her true condition to her mother. She has already seduced 2 of her maids, whose scheming was discovered in time to stop them succeeding. She herself is responsible for the loss of those 2 unfortunates, and she repents it now. Acknowledging the unchanging nature of her fate, she makes the best of it and promises not to make any further attempts to seduce the people I place around her. But this secret, Thérèse, what happens to those who betray me, all this obliges me to surround her only with people abducted as you have been, in order to avoid in this way any prosecutions. Having taken you from no one, and so not having to answer for you to anyone, I am in a better position to punish you if you deserve it, in a manner which, although it may rob you of your life, cannot attract any sort of investigations or other unwelcome attention. From this time on, therefore, you no longer belong to the outside world, since you can disappear from it whenever I wish. So you see that such is your fate, my child. Happy, if you behave yourself well. Dead, if you seek to betray me.
In any other case, I would ask for a response, but I have no need of one in view of the situation you are in. I have you in my power, and you must obey me, Therese. Let's go and see my wife.
Finding no arguments to voice against such a true account, I followed my master. We crossed a long gallery, as dark and as secluded as the rest of the castle. A door opened and we entered an antechamber, where I recognized the two old women who had looked after me while I was poorly. They rose and led us into a magnificent apartment, where we found the wretched Comtesse doing frame embroidery on a chaise longue. She got up when she caught sight of her husband.
"Sit down," the Comte said to her. "You have my permission to remain seated while you hear what I have to say. I have at last found you a chambermaid, madame, and here she is," he continued. "I hope you will recall the fate which you brought upon the others, and that you will not try to plunge this one into the same misfortune."
"There would be no point," I then said, full of desire to serve this unfortunate, and wishing to disguise my intentions. "Yes, madame, if I may be allowed to stress this to you, it would be pointless, because I shall immediately report every word you say to me to Monsieur your husband, and I shall certainly not risk my life to serve you."
"I shall not undertake anything that might place you in such a position, mademoiselle," said this poor woman, who did not yet understand my reasons for speaking thus. "Rest assured, all I ask of you is to take care of me."
"I shall be attentive to all your needs, madame," I replied, "but that is all." And, delighted with me, the Comte shook my hand, whispering in my ear,
"Good, Therese, your fortune is made if you behave as you say you will."
The Comte then showed me my room adjoining the Comtesse's, and pointed out to me that there was no hope of escape from this apartment, which was everywhere secured by solid doors and windows that were framed with double grills.
"There is a terrace, of course," Monsieur de Gernande continued, leading me into a small garden located on the same level as the apartment. "But given its elevation, I feel sure you won't be wanting to gauge the height of the walls. The Comtesse may come here to take the air whenever she pleases, and you will keep her company. Farewell."
I returned to my mistress's side, and as we began by silently studying each other, I was able to capture her well enough during these first few moments to provide a portrait of her. Aged 19 and a half years, Madame de Gernande had the loveliest and the most majestic figure it was possible to see. Not one of her gestures or movements that was not graceful, not one of her looks that was not full of feeling. Although she was blonde, her dark eyes were so beautiful that nothing could compare with their expressiveness, but a sort of languor, the result of her misfortunes, softened their luster, making them 1,000 times more attractive. She had the whitest skin and the loveliest hair, a tiny mouth, too small perhaps, and yet I would have been surprised if anyone considered this a fault. It was a pretty rose not fully opened, but her teeth were so white, her lips so red, it seemed as if Cupid had painted them with colours borrowed from the goddess of flowers. Her nose was narrow and aquiline, pinched at the top and crowned with 2 ebony eyebrows. Her chin was extremely pretty, and in short, she had the loveliest oval-shaped face in which reigned overall a sort of charm, naivety, and candour that would have led one to take her enchanting countenance for that of an angel, rather than the physiognomy of a mortal. Her arms, her bosom, her buttocks, were so round and white that she might have served as an artist's model. The temple of Venus was covered with a thin, dark moss, below which were a pair of well-rounded thighs, and what I found astonishing was that, in spite of her misfortunes, her plumpness remained unaffected. Her chubby, round buttocks were as plump and fleshy and firm as if she had a fuller figure, and had always lived in the happiest of surroundings. And yet, everywhere on her body could be seen the terrible traces of her husband's libertinism. But, I repeat, without spoiling anything, the overall image was that of a beautiful lily where the bee has left a few marks. Madame de Gernande combined so many gifts with a sweet nature, a gentle and romantic turn of mind, and the most sensitive heart. She was talented and well-educated, and possessed a natural gift for seduction that only her vile husband could possibly have resisted. The sound of her voice was so charming and so devout. Such was the Comte de Gernon's unfortunate wife. Such was the angelic creature against whom he had plotted. It seemed that the more inspiring she was, the more she inflamed his ferocity, and that the abundance of gifts she had received from nature only served as further promptings to this villain's cruelties. "What day were you bled, madame?" I said to her, in order to make it clear to her that I knew everything.
3 days ago," she told me, "and it's tomorrow."
Then, with a sigh, she added,
"Yes, tomorrow. Mademoiselle, tomorrow. You will be witness to this fine spectacle.
And is Madame not growing weaker?"
"Oh, dear heaven, I am not yet 20 years old, and I'm sure that one is no weaker at the age of 70. But I am comforted by the thought that it will soon end. I cannot possibly live long like this. I shall go to join my father. I shall go to seek in the arms of the supreme being a repose that men have so cruelly denied me in this world." These words broke my heart.
I disguised my feelings, though, wishing to retain my composure, but I secretly promised myself from then on that I would rather lay down my life 1,000 times, if it came to it, than fail to rescue this unfortunate victim of a monster's debauchery from her sorry fate. It was time for the Comtesse's dinner. The two old women came to tell me to take her into her room, and I passed the information on to her. Being used to this, she immediately went out, and assisted by the two valets who had seized me, the two old women served a sumptuous meal at a table where my place was set opposite my mistress. The valets then retired, and the two women informed me that they would not budge from the antechamber, so as to be close enough to receive the orders of Madame relating to anything she might desire. I told the Comtesse this. She took her place, and invited me to do likewise with a friendly and affable air that completely won me over. There were at least 20 dishes on the table.
"As far as such things are concerned, you can see that I am well taken care of, mademoiselle," she said to me.
"Yes, madame," I replied, "and I know that it is Monsieur le Comte's wish that you should want for nothing."
"Oh, yes. But as such attentiveness is motivated solely by cruelty, it has little effect on me."
Given her state of exhaustion and strong natural impulse to repair herself constantly, Madame de Gernande ate a great deal. She expressed a wish for young partridges and a Rouen duckling, which were immediately brought to her. After the meal she went to take the air on the terrace, holding my hand. It would have been impossible for her to go 10 paces without my help. It was then that she showed me all those parts of her body that I have just described to you. She showed me her arms, which were covered in scars.
"Oh, it's not just there," she said to me. "There isn't a single spot on my miserable body where he does not enjoy seeing blood flow."
And she showed me her feet, her neck, beneath her breasts, and several other fleshy parts that were equally covered in scars. On that first day, I restricted my comments to a few mild expressions of sympathy, and we retired. The next day was the Comtesse's fateful day. Monsieur de Gernande, who did not proceed with this operation until after dinner, which he always had before his wife's, sent word to me to come and eat with him. It was then, madame, that I saw this ogre behave in such a terrifying manner that I could not believe my eyes. 4 valets, among whom were the 2 who had brought me to the castle, served this astonishing meal. It deserves to be described in detail, and I shall do so without any exaggeration. I am sure that they did not serve any more just for me, and so what I saw was customary each day. They served 2 soups, one a consommé flavoured with saffron, the other a ham bisque. The middle dish was sirloin of English beef, 8 hors d'oeuvres, 5 of which looked to be lighter but were not, a head of wild boar in the midst of 8 roast dishes which were accompanied by 2 services of side dishes, and 16 fruit desserts. There were ice creams, 6 sorts of wine, 4 kinds of liqueur, and coffee. Monsieur de Gernande helped himself to all the dishes, some of which were completely devoured by him. He drank 12 bottles of wine, four burgundies to begin with, four bottles of champagne with the roast course, then a bottle each of Tokay, Mousseau, Hermitage, and Madeira with dessert. He ended the meal with two bottles of Caribbean liqueur and 10 cups of coffee. As fresh after all that as if he had just woken up, Monsieur Gernand said to me,
"Let's go and bleed your mistress. You will tell me, please, whether I treat her as well as I do you."
Two young boys, whom I had not seen before, the same age as the other ones, were waiting for us at the door of the Comtesse's apartment. It was there that the Comte informed me that he had 12 such that he had replaced each year. These ones appeared still prettier to me than any of those I had seen previously. They were less nervous than the others. We entered. All of the ceremonies that I am going to describe to you now, madame, were those required by the Comte. They were observed regularly each day, the only thing that varied being the location of the bleedings. Simply attired in a dress of flowing muslin, the Comtesse dropped to her knees as soon as the Comte entered.
"Are you ready?"
her husband asked her.
"For anything, monsieur," she humbly replied. "You know full well that I am your victim, and that your wish is my command."
Monsieur de Gernand then told me to undress his wife and to bring her to him. However repugnant I found all these horrors, as you know, madame, I had no option but to submit completely to his will. Look upon me, I beg you, as nothing but a slave in all that I have recounted to you, and all that I have yet to tell you. I complied only when I could not do otherwise, but I did not act willingly in any of these scenarios. I therefore lifted my mistress's dress and led her naked to the side of her husband, who was already seated in a large armchair. Well acquainted with this ceremony, she got up onto this chair and of her own accord offered him that favourite part of her body to kiss which he had enjoyed so much in me, and which seems to arouse him equally in all persons, whatever their sex.
"Spread them, madame,"
the Comte said roughly to her. And for a long time he enjoyed what he liked to see, getting her to adopt different positions in turn, half opening and then squeezing it shut again. With the tips of his fingers or his tongue, he tickled the narrow orifice, and soon, carried away by the ferocity of his passions, he would nip her flesh, squeezing and scratching it. And as each small wound opened up, he would immediately glue his mouth to it. During these cruel preliminaries, I would hold down his unfortunate victim, and the two young boys, completely naked, would do duty for him. Taking turns to kneel between his legs, they used their mouths to excite him. It was then that I saw, not without astonished surprise, that this giant, this sort of monster whose very appearance terrified people, was scarcely a man. The thinnest, the tiniest excrescence of flesh, or to employ a more precise comparison, what one would see in a 3-year-old infant, was the most you could make out in an individual who was so huge and so corpulent everywhere else, and yet his sensations were none the less acute, and every shiver of pleasure was, in him, an attack of spasms. After this initial session, he lay on the couch and got his wife to straddle him so that her behind still covered his face, while she rendered him the same service of sucking with her mouth that he had just received from the young Ganymedes, who were now both simultaneously excited by him with his hands. Meanwhile, my own worked upon his behind. I tickled and defiled it in every possible way. Having adopted this approach for more than a quarter of an hour without any effect, I had to change tack. By order of her husband, I laid the Comtesse on her back on a chaise longue, with her thighs as wide open as possible. The sight of what she opened up like this threw the Comte into a kind of rage. He thinks for a moment. He darts thunderous looks. He blasphemes. Then he throws himself like a madman upon his wife, pierces her with his lancet in 5 or 6 places on her body. But all of these wounds were slight, producing a few drops of blood at the most. These initial cruelties finally ceased, to give way to others. The Comte sits again, letting his wife breathe for a moment, to focus his attention on the two favourites. He made them suck each other, or else he positioned them in such a way that while he was sucking one, the other sucked him, and so that the one he was sucking performed the same service with his mouth to the one by whom he was sucked. The comte received much, but gave nothing. His satiety and his impotence were such that the very greatest efforts could not even drag him from his torpor. He appeared to experience very violent titillation, but nothing happened. Occasionally he commanded me to suck his little friends myself, and straightway to deliver the incense that I collected into his mouth. He finally set each one in turn on the wretched comtesse. These young men went up to her, insulted her, and were insolent enough to beat her and slap her face, and the more they molested her, the more they were praised, the more they were encouraged by the comte. Gernande then turned his attentions to me. I was in front of him with my bottom level with his face, and he paid homage to his god but did not molest me. I do not know why he did not torment his Ganymedes either, while assaulting the comtesse alone. Perhaps the honour of belonging to him had become a right to be mistreated by him. Perhaps he was really excited by cruelty only because of the element of force in these outrages. Anything is possible in the minds of such individuals, and you can bet that whatever appears most criminal will be what inflames them the most. He finally places his young men and me beside his wife, mixing us together, man-woman, man-woman, and all four of us presenting our behinds to him. He first stands opposite, inspecting us from a little distance. Then he comes closer, touching, comparing, caressing us. The young men and I were not made to suffer from this, but whenever he came to his wife, he would plague and torment her one way or another. The scene changed once again. He had the comtesse laid on her stomach on a sofa, and taking each of the young men in turn, he introduced them himself into the narrow canal offered to them by Madame de Gernande's position. He allows them to become excited there, but it is in his mouth only that the sacrifice must be consummated. He sucks each of them equally as they withdraw. While one performs, he has himself sucked by the other, and his tongue strays to the throne of pleasure presented to him by the boy performing. This activity is lengthy, and the comte tires of it. So he gets up, and wants me to take the comtesse's place. I immediately beg him not to require this of me, but in vain. He places his wife on her back along the length of the sofa, makes me lie on top of her, with my bottom turned towards him, and commands his favourites to probe me by the forbidden route. He brings each to me, introducing them into me with his own hands. I am then obliged to excite the comtesse with my fingers and kiss her on the mouth. As for him, his offering is the same, as each of his favourites cannot act without displaying one of the sweetest objects of his devotion to him. He takes full advantage of this, and as for the comtesse, after a few thrusts, the boy who is drilling me must go and squirt into his mouth the incense brought forth for me. When the young men have finished, he presses himself against my bottom as if he wishes to replace them.
"There's no point in this," he cries. "That's not what I need. To business, to business! However woeful my state may appear, I cannot wait any longer. Come, contest your arms."
He then seizes her ferociously, positions her as he had me, with her arms attached to the ceiling by two black ribbons. I am charged with the job of securing the strips of cloth. He inspects the bindings, and finding them inadequate, he tightens them, so that he says the blood will come out with greater force. He feels the veins and pierces both of them almost at the same time. The blood spurts out a long way, and he is in ecstasy. Again positioning himself opposite while these two fountains flow, he has me kneel between his legs so that I may suck him. He gets both of his favourites to do the same in their turn, all the time keeping his eyes fixed on those jets of blood that inflame him. As for myself, certain that the instant that the crisis he hopes will take place will signal the end of the comtesse's trials, I do all I can to hasten it, and as you can see, madame, I have become whore through goodwill and libertine through virtue. The denouement that we awaited so desperately finally arrived. I had no idea how violent and dangerous it would be, since I had fainted the last time it had occurred. Oh, madame, what frenzy! Gernande was delirious for almost 10 minutes, thrashing around like a man in the throes of an epileptic fit and uttering cries that must have been audible a league away. His cursing was excessive, and striking out at all around him, he was terrifying to behold. The two favourites were knocked down, and he was about to hurl himself upon his wife, but I managed to contain him. He let me finish sucking him, the need he had of me making him respect me. I eventually was able to calm him down by releasing from him that burning liquor, the heat, thickness, and above all, abundance of which put him into such a frenetic state that I thought he was about to expire. 7 or 8 spoons would scarcely have sufficed to contain the amount, and its consistency was thicker than the thickest porridge. This happened without an erection, and with the very appearance of exhaustion. Such contrarieties are better explained by those familiar with the art. The Comte ate excessively, and expended energy in this fashion only when he bled his wife, that is, every 4 days. Was this the cause of this phenomenon? I know not, and not daring to offer reasons for what I do not understand, I shall do no more than describe what I saw. In any event, I ran to the Comtesse, staunched the flow of her blood, untied her, and lay her on a sofa in a state of extreme weakness. But the Comte suddenly left the room with his favourites without showing the slightest concern, and without deigning even to glance at the wretched victim of his rage, leaving me to restore everything to order as I wished. Such is the fatal indifference that, more than anything else, characterizes the mind of a true libertine. If he were carried away only by the ardour of his passion, remorse would be painted in his features when he saw the deadly consequences of his delirium. But if his soul is totally corrupt, he will not fear such consequences, observing them without pain or regret, perhaps even exhibiting still some trace of those vile lusts that produced them. I helped Madame de Gernon to retire. From what she told me, this time she had lost much more than usual, but she was treated with so much care and so many restoratives that 2 days later there was no trace left of her ordeal. That same evening, as soon as I had completed my duties with the Comtesse, Gernon summoned me to go and speak with him. He was having supper, and I was obliged to serve him at this meal, which was conducted by him with even more intemperance than dinner. 4 of his favourites accompanied him at table. Regularly every evening the libertine drank himself to intoxication, but 20 bottles of the most excellent wines were scarcely sufficient to achieve this, and I frequently saw him get through 30. Supported by his favourites, the libertine then went to bed each evening with a couple of them, but he put no personal effort into any of this, which was nothing more than a rehearsal for the main performance. However, I had found the secret of winning this man's highest esteem. He openly confessed that few women had pleased him as much. This helped me to gain his confidence, which I exploited solely to serve my mistress. One morning, when Gernon had summoned me to his study to inform me of some new plans for libertine activities, and having listened carefully to him and applauded him warmly, when I saw that he was in quite a calm mood, I tried to touch his heart with regard to the plight of his unfortunate wife. "Is it possible, monsieur," I said to him, "that a woman can be treated in such a manner, even regardless of all her ties to you? Please deign to consider the touching graces of her sex."
"Oh, Thérèse," replied the Comte, "how can someone with intelligence try to calm me down with arguments that positively work me up all the more? Listen, my child,"
he went on, bidding me sit next to him.
"Whatever invectives you hear me proffer against your sex, no emotion, please. I shall bend to reasoned argument if it is well made. I ask you, Thérèse, what is your justification for claiming that a husband should be obliged to make his wife happy? And by what right does this wife dare to demand it from her husband? The necessity of such a mutual obligation can rightfully only exist between two beings who possess an equal capability to harm each other, and consequently between two beings of equal strength. Such an association can only exist where a pact is immediately formed between these two beings to use their strength only in such a fashion that can cause no harm to either of them,
But this ridiculous covenant could assuredly not exist between a strong individual and a weak individual. By what right could the latter demand that the former should spare him? And how could the strong ever be so stupid as to agree to do so? I can agree not to use my superior force with a person who is able to inspire fear by virtue of his own, but on what grounds would I reduce the impact of my strength against a person subjected to me by nature? Do you reply out of pity? This feeling is compatible only with that being who is like me, and as he is selfish, it would take effect only on the tacit condition that the individual who inspires pity in me will feel the same way with respect to me. But if I consistently prove myself to be superior in strength to him, so that his sympathy becomes useless to me, I am never obliged to agree to any sacrifice in order to obtain it. Would I not be a fool to pity the chicken killed for my dinner? This creature, which is too far beneath me and has no relationship whatever with me, could never inspire any feeling in me. Now, the relationship of a wife with her husband is no different in effect from that of the chicken with me. Both are domestic animals which we are obliged to make use of, that we must exploit in accordance with the uses with which nature endows them, and without there being any difference of any kind between them. But I ask you, if nature's intention was that your sex was created for the happiness of ours, and vice versa, would this blind nature have been so inept in the construction of both of these sexes? Would it have given them both such grave faults that a mutual estrangement and antipathy were inevitably bound to result? There is no need to look for any further examples. Just tell me, I beg you, Therese, given the character you know I have, what woman could I make happy? And conversely, what man can enjoy pleasuring a woman unless he is endowed with the gigantic proportions necessary to satisfy her? Will it, in your opinion, be his moral qualities that will make up for his physical inadequacies? And what reasonable person, knowing women well, will not cry with Euripides? He among the gods who gave birth to woman can boast of having produced the worst among all creatures, and the most tiresome for man. If, then, it is proved that the two sexes are not at all compatible with each other, and that there is not a single complaint made by one that is not immediately applicable to the other, it is consequently false that nature has created them for their reciprocal happiness. It may have granted them the desire to get close to each other in order to achieve the goal of propagation, but not to link up with the view to finding mutual happiness. Therefore, being in no position to expect to receive the pity of the stronger, and no longer being able to argue that the latter can find his happiness with her, the weaker of the two has no other alternative but submission, as in spite of the difficulty of achieving this mutual happiness, it is up to the individuals of both sexes to strive to do this. The weaker must by her submission attract to herself the only bit of happiness that it is possible for her to enjoy, and the stronger must work at achieving his own by whatever means of oppression that it pleases him to employ, since it is proven that the strong are happy only when exercising their faculties of strength, that is, through the greatest possible oppression. Thus this happiness that the two sexes may find in each other can be found by one through blind obedience, and by the other through the greatest possible domination. If it were not nature's intention that one of the sexes should tyrannize the other, would she not have created them of equal strength? In making one inferior to the other in all respects, has she not adequately indicated that her will was for the stronger to make use of those rights that she has given him? The more the stronger extends his authority, the more he in doing so makes the woman that fate has bound to him unhappy, and the better he fulfills nature's intentions. This process is not to be judged according to the complaints of the weaker being. In this case, the judgments could only be faulty, since in making them, you would be espousing the thoughts of the weak alone. The action must be judged according to the power of the strong and the degree to which he has extended his power, and when the effects of this strength